Nee, man, ja, jetzt hast du.
In the earliest days, animal horns were used to make loud and terrifying noises. They called the family together and called on allies, and they scared the enemies. Horns have traveled with hunters and traveled with priests. They've traveled with warriors and with kings. They have been called the instruments of angels and instruments of the devil. Today, horns go just about anywhere they want to go. They go to the symphony, they play in marching bands, they play in whole horn choirs, and they play all by themselves. On this edition of Conversations, we'll take a look at one particular horn, the French horn, with French horn virtuoso Sharon Moe. Sharon, welcome.
Hi, welcome. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. I wanted to ask you about something you said to me very recently. You said, well, the horn is the center of the musical universe. Can you tell me what that means to you in terms of, especially in terms of instrumentation? How does the horn sit in the center?
When I say that, I get people who are who play other instruments give me a little variation and difference, but I really do believe that the French horn has a certain center in the whole of the musical universe that puts the French horn as a link between the brasses and the woodwinds and the strings. And also, the French horn is an instrument that when it plays in a woodwind quintet, which is made up of flute, oboe, clarinet, bassoon, it's called a woodwind. When it plays in a brass quintet, it's considered a brass. And so it's like an instrument that's used with everything. It plays great solos with strings. There's a beautiful thing in the Shostakovich Fifth where Shostakovich uses it, the strings underneath and the flute and the horn are kind of in a duo with each other. It also is used in films. It's used in commercials. It's used in rock. It's used in jazz. It's used as a solo instrument.
I was trying to, when I was listening to you in recital and then listening to a tape, I was trying to find words that would anchor for me the sound of the French horn. I couldn't do it. Is that something of what you mean too? Is that it's? I mean, don't all instruments hold universes of music in them, and so that's not unusual? Or is that unusual with the French horn to you?
In terms of the sound of the instrument?
Yeah.
I think that's a really good thing that you said, because I believe that the French horn has incredible colors. Mm-hmm. And the more colors that you get from the horn, the more beauty and the more sound and the more interesting it is to the person listening and also to the person playing. So there are a great many different colors that you can get on the French horn.
And does color mean to you that it can travel into a commercial or classical music or jazz music? Or,
well, that's more, I think that's more styles.
Good.
But the color would be something that you get in the sound.
Yes.
And the changes of the different types of sound you get. Each person that plays an instrument, especially with the French horn, I could pick up several different instruments of the French horn and get my own sound. And so it doesn't really matter which instrument I play, because what I am as a person, all of that and how I think and what I feel goes into making my sound. And I can listen to different players and know who's playing what because of their sound.
Really? Close your eyes and you know it's...
Yeah, pretty much. Huh. Especially with a solo thing.
Does that mean to you that at different times in your life then you have played different French horns because there have been different Sharon Moes playing?
No, I think the instrument is just the means to making music. Mm-hmm. And there are different kinds of French horns that you can play, like you can play a Kahn, or you can play a Paxman, or you can play an Alexander, or you can play a Holton. And all of those instruments, it's like if you pick out a piano.
Yes.
The piano is the means to the end, not the end in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. I talked to Bruce Berry a couple of years ago, who's a horn player on original instruments with the Chestnut Brass Company, and he said the horn is the closest thing to life because it's played with the breath. It's deeply connected with the thing that keeps the human alive.
I like what he says there.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah. What made you play that? He said that's why he plays the horn rather than any other instrument, because his first attraction was music, and his second one, and then lifelong one, was horn. What brought you to the horn in general, and then to the French horn?
My mother was a singer, a wonderful singer, and my father was very musical, and we have five children in our family, and we were all taken to concerts. And of course, we all studied piano at the age of like 4 or 5 and sang. Mm. And then when you're around 10 or 11, you choose a stringed or a brass instrument. Especially brass instrument, you start a little later. Strings, you can start earlier now because they have the smaller instruments that the kids can play. So some of them start at 2 and 3, you know, with a Suzuki. But with brass, there's a certain physical development you have to be beyond in terms of your lungs and how large you are in order to take. Play a French horn or trumpet. If it's the huge instrument, you can't hold it up, you know.
Right.
We went to concerts and we had learned all the instruments, and we were told we could choose whichever one we wanted. And I always thought that the French horn had the most incredible parts. They always had the incredible climax, like the great opening solo of Till Eulenspiegel by Strauss has this wonderful horn solo. Tchaikovsky's Fifth, all of a sudden there's this magnificent horn solo. And then it made you cry, or it was like heroic, or all these different sounds that would come out. So I thought, this is the instrument for me.
Have you looked back sometimes and said, my goodness, what a gift my family was, given the fact that music seems to be your life, I mean, natural to your life?
I do. I've always felt very blessed with my family. My mother and father were extremely, they never really said to me, you can do anything or be anything that you want to do or be, but it was always there. And maybe if I decided to do something, they would just always be there to support me. I do remember when I won the Young Artist Contest with the Minnesota Orchestra, and I had won a huge scholarship to go to a school in New York. And I was going to St. Olaf College at the time. And I wanted to stay and finish St. Olaf College and then go on to school. But I won a whole bunch of different things, money and mm-hmm. scholarship and playing with, debut with the orchestra and that kind of thing. But I remember my father saying, because I had about $200 to my name, and he said, what are you going to do when this money runs out? And I said, I'll find a job. But I was going to school. So I think he was concerned about, having been in New York and gone to school there himself, what were my plans? But that was the only time that there was ever any little doubt in what he said.
It was a very subtle nudge, too.
It was a little bit, yeah. But I never really worried too much about that.
Sharon Moe is with us on this edition of Conversations. She is she's called a French horn virtuoso, and actually I'm going to ask her what that qualifying term means to her in a moment. She performs regularly with symphonies. She performs as a soloist. She is a recording artist for compact discs, for television, for films. Perhaps this is what the word virtuoso certainly means. Sharon Moe is principal horn, variously, for the New York City Opera, the Long Island Philharmonic, the Bronx Arts Ensemble, the New York Chamber Soloists, the American Symphony, and the Colonial Symphony, among others. She has a very busy schedule as a performer and is able to work into these various symphonies and ensembles as they ask and her life allows. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. Tell me about that word, virtuoso, to you. We use it to raise up the best and say this person is the best, but it also speaks of it must also speak of freedom, because a virtuoso is also an innovator and an investigator in the instrument, and it means you have thorough knowledge, I think. Is there a way for you to say, beyond kind of ego things, what virtuoso means?
Probably virtuoso to me means that you can play anything on the instrument that you want to play.
Yeah, it is freedom.
I think. And I've always felt with the French horn that it was an extremely natural thing to me. It's always been talked about that the French horn is an extremely difficult instrument to play. And I think any instrument to play well is very difficult, but it's always been said that the French horn is one of the most difficult to play. I've always sort of ignored that because it's a wonderful way for me to make music and give beauty to other people through this. And I love playing it. I love playing all kinds of music on it. I love making music. And I feel almost like when I'm on, not that I'm on, when I'm on the stage, but being on the stage making music is a very comfortable place for me. It feels like being at home for me.
Do you know why that's true?
No.
Yeah, because for some people it's absolutely petrifying.
And it doesn't really have to do with whether I get nervous or not, because I think all artists, to some degree, have some kind of nervousness about it. It's just that you learn to play through that.
Right.
And I know, who I will not mention, a very famous cellist who becomes ill before every performance and then goes out on stage and everything is fine. So everybody deals with it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
But I just feel it's like it's kind of a blessing in a way. I feel very much at home.
Mm-hmm. Was that true as a learner as well? This was your instrument and performing was...
Well, I played piano. I did a lot of concertos with orchestras and things with piano up until, actually, up through college. Mm. And then I had a serious accident, brain accident. Mm. I fell on the ice and I was on tour with the St. Olaf College Band and slipped and wound up not being able to play the horn for a while, and no one could see me except for my teacher, and there was huge snowstorms and my parents couldn't get there, and
right.
So I had a few people that were able to see me, and this happened when I was a sophomore in college, and I think what it did is it, I always knew that music was important to me and I always knew certain things were very important to me, but all of a sudden I all these things sort of came into place, and I realized that playing the horn was something that I really did want to do, and there was some question about whether I might be able to or not.
Huh. You can tell me if this is too personal, and just we'll go on mm-hmm. from on to something else, but did you have to come back from your injury and relearn your instrument and your life as a musician?
Nothing was damaged in the brain, but they were concerned about the fact of what that would do in terms of there is a certain amount of not really pressure. Well, I guess, yeah, maybe a little bit of pressure when you play. And I lied a lot when I first went back. They wanted, my teacher had to be right there for several weeks whenever I played. And I used to get terrible headaches and lie about it, which was probably not the smartest thing to do. And so I used to go back after those things and cry a lot. But it turned out okay.
And this is just the forming of resolve. I will play my instrument.
Well, maybe. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
I have an odd question. They say that when a person is fluent in a second language, the fluency shows in that the person thinks in that language. Is there such a thing as thinking in French horn? Do you? No, I'll ask you that
no,
way.
No, I think probably thinking in music,
yes.
but not thinking in French horn. Maybe I should ask you to ask me more about what you mean by that, because maybe I'm not sure what you mean by that. But I think that if I understand your question, I think you would tend to think more in a musical sense, as music is another language. And yes, music is always going around in my head in terms of that.
And is that long after Beethoven was deaf, they said the music played for him
sure. In
his silent head. That is what this is music
that's,
plays.
That's what happens to me when I write music. I mean, there's mm-hmm. always music swirling around in my head. Mm-hmm. And something's always, like, jutting in and out of my my musical brain. And either something familiar or something that I am wanting to write. Or some great work that I just did the night before, and it's just there all the time.
Yes. I want to ask you about this intersection. Sharon Moe is also known as Sharon Moe Miranda. She uses her full name as a composer. When you hear of her as Sharon Moe, she is a performer, which is interesting to me that you kind of divide yourself in that way, nominally, so to speak. But because you are a composer, and a composer of some distinction and note, as well as a French hornist, is that the way you say that, French hornist?
Yes. Right.
Of who is known as a virtuoso, I'm interested in how these two expertises, these two languages and understandings of the universe have impacted each other. Has the performer changed as the composer has emerged? Does the composer change because of the fact of the performer?
That's a good question. I have always done composing. As a child, I did composing too. I guess I started writing things down. I was always doing things on the piano and writing different things, but I think I started writing things down somewhere around 8 or 9, and my mother would say, I need this, so I would write something. Or my band director would say, I need this, so I would write something.
This, a song?
Yeah, uh-huh. Like, I write me this, or write me that. And then in our family, my brother is a writer, and with the three other kids in our family, and one of my sisters is a professional flutist, Carla. And so my brother used to write a play, and I would write the music, and then we'd put it all together and put it on for my parents. Usually it was like maybe twice a year for Christmas or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so the composing has sort of always been with me in terms of that. But composing is sort of thinking of all the instruments, of all the whole spectrum of voice and of the orchestra and all the different styles that go into that. French horn is thinking of all the music, but through the means of the French horn. And I think, yes, one maybe enhances the other.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you think as a performer, as a musician, that you have I don't know what the quality is, a deeper or broader relationship with the music, the other musicians, the composer, the conductor, because of the fact of your life awareness as a composer? Or is that any musician's job to reach out through all those different parts of the music?
Well, I think every person who's a musician, who's an artist, probably reaches out to bring all these things together, to become, to grow and to learn more and to know more and to maybe be a better artist. But as a composer, I think maybe the circle is even a little bit wider, because you're thinking of all the things together.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
I found myself wondering about parents and children, perhaps because you reach back and talk about your family. If you were to talk to parents of children who wanted to play an instrument, should they start with the piano but turn to horn when the body is ready? Why would you say horn or not horn? Or
I think it's a good thing for kids. Well, kids are always singing. You know, that's a wonderful thing, to always have your, I mean, in school and wherever, they're always singing in church and synagogues, whatever.
Right.
And so in that sense, they're always doing music. And kids, just basically, little children are always like bursting into song if you, you know, don't put them down for that. But I think piano is a wonderful instrument to start out with because you don't have to worry about tuning anything. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about the breath or anything. Not to say the piano is an easy instrument, but piano gives a sense of being able to have an immediacy.
Yes.
Push
it and it makes a sound.
Yeah.
Yes.
And also there are harmonies on the piano. If you take if you play French horn or you play violin, you can get double stops. But if you take French horn or clarinet or flute, there's a single line. And so you also enhance your harmonic sense with the piano. And then you're too little also to take the horn. I started the horn at age 10. Mm-hmm. In fourth, fifth grade is a good time to do that because of your lungs.
You're a big kid, little kid?
I think I was little. I actually, which instrument you play has nothing to do with the size of who you are, just like a singer.
Right.
It has to do with your breath control and how you use your breath control and your lungs and that. So as natural as breathing. And the less extraneous things you put into playing the instrument, the better off you are.
That is to say, the more focused it is on chest and
lungs? Just pick it up and just breathe and play. Uh-huh. Don't bring all kinds of extraneous other things into it.
Okay.
But that's an easier said thing than done.
Right. So tell me about breath. But my first curiosity is, after however many years, decades I assume, you've played this mm-hmm. instrument, do you have what I non-player would think of as a huge breath capacity? And what does that mean?
Since you don't play the French horn, it would be you swim, right? Do you swim underwater? So when you swim underwater, you hold your breath. Or sometimes when you swim, you let the air out, right? So when you're playing a brass instrument or a woodwind instrument, the breath is the bow, like the strings. Mm-hmm. So when you stop the breath, the sound is not there. So usually when you're doing the breath, it would be like, ah, and that would be like the French horn. If you go, ah, there's no more sound left. Mm-hmm. So the breath is something that you ride on the breath to make the music. And where you stop the breath is in the rests or in a phrase marking. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or when you need to take breath because you're out of breath. But the breath is really what the music rides on.
Right.
And yes, you develop, to hold notes out until endless, yeah.
But it's mostly holding. But there's quality, too, isn't mm-hmm. there, of the air?
The faster that you push the breath through, mm-hmm. the stronger the sound is going to be. Mm-hmm. The slower the breath, the softer the sound. Mm-hmm. And also there's articulations that you do to make staccato, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, or da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, with different things that you do with.
And this is tongue training and jaw training and breath training.
Jaw doesn't have too much. Well, a little bit, maybe, if you drop to a low note or something. But, uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Huh. I should have brought my horn. I could have.
We could do this.
Given
this
you a lesson.
This is the non-horn lesson. Right. That's right. Yeah, this is the question I want to ask. Do you get tired or do you get stronger? When you played in recital last night, you played for 2 hours, 15 minutes or so. That's a long time to be playing. Do you tire or do you get stronger over the years?
I think that endurance has something to do with pacing yourself, mm-hmm. and also I don't think that you could do a 2.5 hour or a 2 hour or an hour and a half playing if you haven't practiced and built up and know how to do that. I think a young child starting out could not play for a long time without getting tired. You build a certain strength in the way you do.
Lips and cheeks.
But also, if I would put the horn away for 3 days, which I usually don't do, if I stop practicing for a couple of days, my endurance would not be as good as if I continue. So.
Do you practice daily, and how much?
I do. If I'm not, well, it depends, because you can't play, like with piano, you can play many, many hours without being exhausted. And with the horn, there's only a certain amount of time that you can do that. Like if you have a concert and, say, a film recording, and then you have another rehearsal in the morning, you have to be careful, and if you're practicing as well. But mm-hmm. I never let a day go by without playing.
And is that both technique and pleasure? Or is that the job?
Yes,
part?
No, yes. I think it's, I always want to say to kids, like my daughter studies piano and she sings, Antonia. She's 11. And some days she hates to practice. Yeah. And it's because she has other things that she's thinking about. And she's wonderful. She's a wonderful musician. And I said, Antonia, sometimes I hate to practice. So it's that what practicing is, sometimes it's wonderful and sometimes it's frustrating. And I think that it has to do with maintaining the technique and the tone and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can play well, you can add heart to technique, but without technique, heart alone is not enough.
I think that if you're talented, that you can always learn technique. You cannot always learn how to make great music.
Uh-huh. And that's the gift of the universe.
Yes. Yeah. I think there are people who start out and they have a wonderful sense of musicality, but you have to balance the two. In order to really play great music, you have to be able to get through and not worry about the technique anymore. I mean, you do always practicing to hone your skills, but...
But that's the foundation. That's
You can't teach... You can teach phrasing to people, but you cannot teach great artistry. You cannot teach great musicality to somebody. They either have that musicality or they don't.
Yeah. On this edition of Conversations, we're talking with Sharon Moe, the French hornist, French horn virtuoso, and also Sharon Moe Miranda. It's funny, I can't help but separate your names, although it's not quite fair to do that. Our guest, both French hornist and composer, Sharon Moe Miranda, on this edition of Conversations. She mentioned earlier that she won the Young Artists Competition with the Minnesota Orchestra. That was when she was 17 years old. She then made her debut with that orchestra. Not much later, I gather. You can straighten me out if I'm wrong. Sharon Moe was chosen by Leonard Bernstein to perform as solo horn for his premiere work, The Mass, of which many of us have heard, at Kennedy Center. She later recorded that for Leonard Bernstein. Her degrees are from St. Olaf College and from Manhattan School of Music. We're talking with Sharon Moe, French hornist and composer. This is Conversations. You mentioned your daughter, Antonia, and also coming from a musical family. I haven't told our audience quite everything that you do, but it's a long, busy list of life occupations, truly. Yes. How does family play in your life and music play in your life, and where do you have to bend and flex and shut the door and say, no, I'm composing today. Yes, I love you. I'll talk to you later.
That's a complicated question. Mm-hmm. My husband is a French hornist as well. He's a wonderful French horn player. And oftentimes we do concerts together. And as far as one of the things that children like to do is be around their parents a lot. And as Antonia has grown older, when we go, like we went to France with the New York Chamber Soloists and played concerts there in all over France, and we were able to take Antonia with us, and so she came along with us on those things. But in terms of composing and performing, and that in one way being an artist is a very lucky thing in terms of my daughter and having children, because mm-hmm. the schedule is not go out in the morning at 7 and return at 6 or 7 at night and not see your child, which I think would be very rough. And I know that that's really hard on women and men too, who have to do that, on mothers and fathers. Sometimes my schedule would be doing a rehearsal in the morning, come back and see my daughter, and then maybe have a performance at night or whichever, when she was small. Now she's in school, and I always try to connect with her in some way at a major part of the day. So we always have some connection with that. If I'm away, I always call her,
mm-hmm.
And you know, my husband too. If he's, we try not to, while she's little, go away together.
Oh, all right, away from her together.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so in that sense, she always has one person there that. But we have done that at times when we had a person who was taking care of her for quite a while that did stay. So there was a consistency there. But when I have deadlines with composing, like if I have a commissioned piece that has to be done, and I'm in the middle of a deadline and it's got to be done to go to the copyist, and all of a sudden my daughter has a major thing that has to be done, at first I would say I'll be right back, and I would go to do that, and it would wind up with me thinking about her so much that I never got anything done anyway, mm-hmm. and I felt, I don't know, there's only a short time that you have with your children, and they're really like a blessing, so she's only going to be at home probably for another 6 or 7 years, and then she's going to be out on her own, and so I just decided that the 5 or 10 minutes that I could be with her to do whatever needed to be done, I would do it. I would just stop what I was doing and go and do it.
Has that allowed a fuller composing life because your priorities are set? Or have you found that your composing life has lost anything in that exchange? Win-win, lose?
You know, I actually think it's better for me.
Yeah.
I think it's made it better for me. I used to think that when you created things that you would go into the creativity part, because there's sort of a place when you start to create the work. Not when you're thinking about it, swirling around your mind, but when you actually start to begin to write it down to be written for people to play it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain place that you are. It's hard for me to describe this, but...
But it is elsewhere.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I used to think that if I went out of that place into reality, so to speak, that I would lose the creative part of where I was. And when I realized that would not happen,
uh-huh.
Then I was fine.
Right.
Yeah. Because there are a lot of variety. There's so many things that you can do in creativity, and I think we tend to limit ourselves as to thinking there's only one way and that's it, and it works for you. So you say, okay, this is it. This works. But and then you're afraid to try something else. Once I sort of opened up that whole scope, I was fine.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you have this, and you can just, again, toss this one off if this isn't a question that fits for you. Do you have a way of looking at yourself as a composer? As a composer, I am this kind of composer?
No.
Okay.
I think it has to do with, like, for instance, if someone asked me to write something for them, and sometimes there's only a certain constraint, like how large the instrumentation of the orchestra is,
right.
Or someone asked me to write a choral and an orchestral piece, or someone asked me to write a song or a children's piece. Maybe every composer feels this way, that there's no one single way, but I think that if you limit yourself to just doing something one way or one style, you tend not to grow. Mm-hmm. And I try real hard to be open to everything, so that I will always constantly be testing the limits, so to speak, or hopefully there aren't any limits.
And is this also why you're, I understand you're working on an opera now, you've finished a children's piece, you worked on a commemorative piece for women who have been touched by breast cancer, there are symphonic pieces and choral pieces, and is this why for you?
I don't think there's any particular reason why. I think it's just that ideas are always popping into my mind,
yep.
And I'm very often connecting with people who will bring something up which will all of a sudden have another creative thing that's going. And I tend to be a little here and there in terms of ideas shooting in and out of my mind anyway. Sometimes even my conversations jump mm-hmm. from subject to subject, and I'm not sure why. It's just sort of the way it is.
That's a question for me. Do you see that as the essential you, and it's just fine, and you let that go to become part of your creative energy? Or have you at different parts in your life said, oh, for heaven's sake, Sharon, get organized, or stick to one thing, or has that troubled you, or has that been part of your...
No, I guess, should it? Maybe it should.
No, actually,
I don't think it has troubled me. I do think having having a child helped me to get extremely organized in the daily, everyday chores of things, and I think it's very possible to work and have a child and do all these things. You just have to get yourself very organized, because there are many wonderful demands and very many terrifying demands of a child that you have to take care of, and if you organize yourself and organize certain things that maybe normally you would not do because it's yourself and your husband. Or I also have a great husband who is very sharing and giving with what he does in terms of helping that way, and we've always tried to help each other that way too.
More of that foundation.
Yeah, and also in terms of helping to organize things, and one sort of goes off the other. I think sometimes it's frustrating for him though when I'm in a creative spot, and we're having major conversations about this with the other day too with some people who are composers, and sometimes when the creative takes over, you're in another place. Mm-hmm. You're grounded, but you're in another place, and this is all encompassing in your mind. And I'm not sure if I'm a different person. But that's always on my mind. I'm still taking care of everything else. I'm performing, I'm doing whatever. But that creative part of me that is there, it is like completely taken over the spectrum. And until that's done, it's not an obsession. It's a different place mm-hmm. that I'm in. Mm-hmm. And one of the great things about composing is I can compose anywhere. I can be in the car or walking in nature or in the subway. I live in New York. In the subway, I can do that. But when you perform, you have to have a room to practice, right. A group to play with. So in that sense, it's lucky that I can do it that way.
Do you truly carry your composition work wherever you go?
My head, you mean? Or
as you're composing, can you in the subway?
Sure.
I've talked with composers who say that at 5 o'clock every morning I'm at the piano or at my computer or with my pencil, whatever it is they use, and I have to be there to do that thing.
I think everybody has their own way. I think maybe because of my schedule and my family and my daughter, that I've just learned to compose at all different times. And I don't have one set time because my schedule is always changing with performances and the needs of my family. Mm-hmm. And actually, I don't think that changed since I had my family. I think that it probably was always that way.
Yeah. I was wondering if this is more who you are.
Yeah.
Sharon Mo Miranda is with us. Among her most recent commissions and compositions is one called Jubilee. It was commissioned by the Fairbanks Symphony, and as of this recording, will be played while Sharon is in Fairbanks on this visit. This visit is in late March of 1995. While in Fairbanks, she has performed for the symphony, she has lectured at the university. She will have also performed a children's concert, one of her own compositions, while she is in Fairbanks.
And the name of the work that I did for the Fairbanks Symphony is Jubilation.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Well,
I think Jubilee is maybe an event.
Yes.
And Jubilation is like a sort of an emotion. Yeah. Is that right? I hope that's right.
It feels right. Jubilation is about your conception of Alaska. You had not been here when you began to compose.
No, that's true. But Alaska is something that I think zips in and out of people's minds, and they think about it because it's when Madeline Schatz called and asked if I would like to write a work for the Fairbanks Symphony, I said that I would love to do this, and I started thinking about Alaska, and how to me Alaska means the beauty of nature, and much of it is untouched by human hands, and then how mm-hmm. how people tend to always want to try to change that, commercialize nature and bring in things like that, and how we how we need to balance that out. And also, when you think of nature, you think of a certain closeness to God that you get when you're communing with nature, and a certain spirituality that happens. And so that sort of is all tied up in this piece. I always hesitate to say words on what my work is unless it actually has some kind of a story connected with it, because I think it limits like your experience of what you might be hearing in my work, and I never would want to put my constraints on your experience. So I hesitate to, but everyone wants to have words connected with it.
It's odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
What did you mean when you wrote that? Yeah. This is a question, but this is the question. Everyone experiences music differently?
I think they do. I think even if you have a story connected, I mean, there are different things that you feel. Like when you watch an opera, everyone, yes, the story is the same, but I think everyone feels something differently than the next person. And especially with music without words, mm-hmm. It's probably each person has their own experience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe many people have the same type of experience, but you're still yourself, and each person is unique.
And there are at least slight variation interpretations for every person who listens.
I think. Yeah. Although it's confusing, because you think of what causes one piece to touch off an entire audience where they rise en masse, standing ovation for your work, and another work is maybe a more thoughtful work, or a work that enrages someone, and so that whole, that'd be a good thing for a study, wouldn't it?
Yeah. What happens?
Yeah, to the overall thing that merges.
Mm-hmm. There seems to be a core, and then variations from there. I suppose the question I was wondering now is, when you're composing, where is the audience? Are we way down the road, not in your consciousness? Are you focused on, as you say, this swirl of ideas and feelings?
I think in the audience in the sense of if I was doing a children's work,
mm-hmm.
I would want to gear that work for children. If I was doing an opera for children, I would gear it to their imagination, whatever. But or if I was going to do a work that, like I did, and I Will Wipe Away Your Tears, for all the people who've been touched by breast cancer, there's a certain thing that has to go into that because it's a special meaning. And so in that sense, yes, the audience. But in writing most other works, I think it's mostly through the creative process,
mm-hmm.
and not trying to think of what will make an audience like your piece or what will enrage them or what. It's more the creative thoughts and the whole creative process that goes into making that work.
Is the creative process as hard to put into words, hard to define, as is a piece of music hard to put into words, hard to define?
Well, maybe. The creative process is different for each work that I do. And I may wake up in the middle of the night and all of a sudden have this great idea, which I think is great, and mm-hmm. say I'll remember it in the morning, you know, and wake up in the morning and not remember it. Or have get up in the middle of the night, be somehow, something wakes me up and I go and I start writing.
It which, moves you. You don't necessarily move
yes,
it.
Yes, sometimes. Moves you. Mm-hmm. Or I may be working on something and I'm saying, this isn't the way I really want it to be. And I'm going to go to bed, and I go to bed, and in the morning, that solution is there. Although they do say that your brain works on solutions at night, so with that in mind,
yes.
I right. tend to do that a lot.
Right.
But I guess my way is that I do a great deal of thinking about what. And ideas start swirling around and coming in and out of my head and in my brain. And then I compose, it sort of starts to come together, and then all of a sudden I sit down and I start putting it on paper to be meticulously done so that whoever's playing it or singing it will be able to understand what I am
mm-hmm.
in terms of that. But I write full out for everything. I don't write like a reduced piano and a choir thing and then put it for the full orchestra if it's for orchestra and chorus. I write it begins writing with the full score for all the instruments as they are. And somebody asked me a question the other day when I was lecturing about I was invited to talk to the kids in the college, and they said, do you know automatically that that's going to be the instrument that you put with that solo?
Mm-hmm.
And yes, usually it is pretty much there in my mind that is the instrument I want on that solo. Although there may be a variation or two if you wanted a particular instrument on a solo and it was in the bass range and you had an oboe.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you couldn't have the oboe play where the bass is, so that would be the only difference. But basically, yeah, that's what I do.
Fiction writers say that their characters begin to speak to them, even if they have created the character. The character begins to speak and then takes over. Does the composition or do parts of the composition, after you have been the catalyst for it, take over, and show you mm-hmm. what to write, how to write? Appearance
yes,
of an
I
thi- oboe.
Yes, yeah. I think in a sense it does. Yes,
uh-huh.
In fact, I'm always that whole process is quite amazing and awesome to me
mm-hmm.
Because it does, and I think a lot of my ideas must be coming from from God and outer space and different things connecting. And I'm a person who believes pretty strongly in the fact that, I mean, I've had this borne out, mm-hmm. that I may be thinking about something or someone, and all of a sudden from way across the country or the world or something, that person calls. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes I've said, I'd really like to write a work for this, and all of a sudden someone calls me and asks if they would like to commission me to write a work for this. I have no idea why this happens. I think it's great and amazing and awesome. And
Sharon Mo Miranda with us on Conversations. I want to ask you about pushing the envelope. You have mentioned a couple of times here and in the lecture that you gave that it's important for a composer to push music, to stretch the boundaries, to open the windows, to make doors, to move things out. But that also music has to stay tied to its roots. I didn't quite phrase it that way, so correct me if I'm wrong, but what does that mean to you in terms of, what does that mean to you as a composer when you sit down?
Well, music, when you compose music, I think that if you become successful at writing, well, with human nature, I think there's a tendency to stay with what is good and familiar and successful, and I think in order to grow spiritually and every other way, that you need to always be open to things. Mm-hmm. I think that as human beings, we tend to be afraid of new things, the unknown, and we're less likely to be open to new things than we are to what is familiar. I think that's why it's hard for people when they hear works, new works, to connect with them. If that work is what you say grounded, or if it's somehow connected to the familiar and the traditional, but also pushing the limits, then there's a little something to connect the audience with what they know is to be familiar, but also what is going into the future. But I think it's necessary for human beings to be open to everything and not to stay in the same place always, because that's the way you grow. And as an artist, I think you need to always be open to that. And someone asked me, did I think that there would be a new music somewhere down the road? I think that things are always changing. Mm-hmm. And I think that if I said no, or if people thought no, mm-hmm. that would mean that where we are now, that's it. And that would be the same. I mean, look at how many years ago no one ever thought the computer would come into being and all these things would be happening. And it's an unbelievable time to be alive with all these things going on. Mm-hmm. On the great side, and also on the terrifying side, because there's so many changes happening so rapidly that I think we do need to be grounded and stable in some ways, but also open to change and variation. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, real well. Well, I was just also thinking about what you said about spirituality and intuition and technique, all three of these. If you are using or opening yourself to them, they will push your music out, but probably also keep you grounded, whatever that means. Yeah. Are these qualities also true for you as a performer? Same thing happens as a performer? Have to stay open and grounded?
I think so. Yes, I remember doing many, many different new works and many masters all new things. I think you have to go to a new work with a very open attitude, because they may be asking you to do something. Well, of course, if the composer asks you to do something that is dangerous and harmful, you naturally rebel.
Right.
I remember one concert in Carnegie Hall where they asked us to play in a piece. I was fairly new in New York, and I guess maybe early, maybe 18 or something, and playing in a concert in Carnegie Hall, and or maybe I was 20. But anyway, they said, make as much noise as you can. And the bassoon player next to me picked up his stand and started. He was doing it as a joke, and the composer thought this was incredible.
He was pounding his stand.
Yeah,
he
was, But
thank you for your contribution.
Right. But I remember doing a work of Oliver Messiaen. He had been commissioned to write a work which was to be done on a concert in Alice Tully with the Musica Turn Orchestra. And it was supposed to be a part of a concert. And the music arrived, and it wound up being almost an hour and 45 minutes of music. So it became the entire program. It's called From the Canyons to the Stars.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, he wrote 12 movements. It was a wonderful work, very difficult, but wonderful work, pushing the limits of everything. And he had written a horn solo, which was about 12 minutes, just for horn, which is unusual in an orchestra. Usually he wrote other horn solos within the 12 movements, but I think it was 12. And he had Yvonne Lorio, his wife, playing the piano, where there were some piano solos and things. And he wrote this horn solo, which wound up being all by itself, and it was his idea of the questions and answers from God. The questions that, I keep hitting my mic, I'm sorry. Questions that would be asked, and the answers that God would give back. This was my solo, and there were some some different things that I had to do on the horn that he wanted to get effects of certain things. It was a wonderful piece and a wonderful experience. He came over and was there It was great.
Yeah. It was great. Sharon, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
It's been quite an hour. You can find recordings by Sharon Moe as Sharon Moe, recording as Sharon Moe. If you look for New World Records, CBS, Newport Classics, Musical Heritage, Deutsche Grammophon, etc. Are any of your works recorded?
No.
Would you know?
No. Well,
okay.
They've been broadcast over the radio, so okay. Windows is radio broadcast. There's been a lot of radio broadcasts.
Okay. Keep your eyes open for the name and ears open for the music. Sharon Moe Miranda, our guest on this edition of Conversations. Thanks again.
Thank you.
And I hope you join us again next week.